It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
At least 34 Congolese massacred by suspected rebels. Dozens of Ethiopian migrants perish on the Red Sea. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. In Democratic Republic of Congo, a coalition of civil society groups say at least 34 people were killed by rebels late Saturday in three villages in the northeast province of North Kivu. The attack came following pledges by the government and United Nations to reestablish security around the town of Beni, where armed groups and militia are vying for control of mineral resources. One civil society group reports machetes and axes were used in the attack. In the past, Congolese organizations blamed the Allied Democratic Forces and National Army for the Liberation of Uganda for such attacks. On his Twitter account, Martin Kobler, head of the UN peacekeeping mission, condemned the attack and called for DRC forces and UN peacekeepers to respond. Gunmen helped more than 200 inmates escape a Nigerian prison overnight, the third massive jailbreak in the West African country since early November. It's unclear who orchestrated the attack on the medium security facility in the central state of Niger. Last week, at least 300 prisoners escaped in the southwest state of Ekiti, and a November plot liberated another 144 in the facility in the south-central state of Kogi. At least 70 Ethiopians drowned in the Red Sea Saturday when a migrant boat bound for Yemen capsized in rough weather, adding to what already has been a record year for maritime smuggling deaths. Security officials said heavy winds and waves battered the vessel before it sank off the port of Al-Maka in Taiz province. In October, the UN Refugee Agency declared 2014 the most dangerous in recent memory for migrants trying to reach Yemen by water. This is VOA News. A 10th doctor in Sierra Leone has died of Ebola. Aya Solomon Konoyima's death occurred late Saturday at an Ebola treatment center in Hastings near Freetown and came a day after two of his colleagues died of the deadly virus. It's another blow to a fragile health system still recovering from the 1990s decade-long civil war. It is believed Sierra Leone had just one doctor for every 50,000 people as of 2010. That's about 120 physicians in the entire country. Saturday, the government announced two other doctors died of Ebola. 11 doctors have been infected. One, so far, has survived. In better news, Cuban doctor Felix Baez, who contracted Ebola in Sierra Leone, has returned home to Cuba after being cured 16 days at a Geneva hospital, where he received experimental treatments. The World Food Program and the British military have been airdropping food by helicopter to residents of Sherbro Island and surrounding islands near Sierra Leone. Zeneb Mansouri is the senior WFP program assistant.
For them to have access to market, they have to use boat, and then they go to like Freetown and the other main markets that are within the country in order to be able to sell their product and buy food. But with the Ebola situation, this has been put to a stop. They cannot travel. And in fact, like the fishes they have, which they have already caught from the sea, cannot be sold for them to have exchange of food.
Meanwhile, in Liberia, the nation's top court has issued a stay on a government order banning public gatherings in Monrovia ahead of elections next week. The decision Friday by the International Criminal Court to drop crimes against humanity charges against Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta over post-election violence is seen by some rights advocates as a blow to international justice, as Lisa Bryant reports.
Mr. Kenyatta and his supporters are cheering the outcome as a vindication of his innocence. But rights advocates like Human Rights Watch's Liz Evanson see it as a setback for justice and for Kenya's victims.
That's why it becomes important to really take a close look here at what happened and what could have been done to bring about cooperation, what could have been done to make sure witnesses felt protected, what could have been done to counter the Kenyan government's propaganda against the court.
Since coming into force in 2002, the ICC has concluded only three cases, including one it wrapped up against Congolese warlord Thomas Lubanga. The court has not acquitted Mr. Kenyatta, which means charges could be pursued in the future if there's more evidence. Meanwhile, an ICC trial continues for Kenya's vice president, William Ruto, who is also charged with organizing post-election violence. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The head of Tunisia's Electoral Commission Sunday said the presidential runoff in the North African country is to be held December 21st. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Monday, December 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Three doctors have died in Sierra Leone from Ebola since last Friday.
We have Dr. Tom Rogers and Dr. Kuruma, who were buried yesterday, and also Dr. Konoyima.
Dr. Brahima Kabo is Sierra Leone's chief medical officer. UNICEF launches an anti-malaria campaign in Sierra Leone. In Liberia, President Sirleaf Sung goes to court today to stop Executive Order No. 65, described as dictatorial. And employees of the Malawi Anti-Corruption Bureau are threatening a strike action today, Monday, to demand a salary increase.
Their option was to go to court, but because the courts are almost dysfunctional, their option was to go on strike after 8 days.
Renek Matemba is deputy director of the Malawi Anti-Corruption Bureau. The U.S. partners with Ethiopian schools to empower women, and protests escalate in the U.S. over police killings and grand jury decisions. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Sierra Leone chief medical officer says he's baffled by the deaths of three Sierra Leone doctors from the Ebola virus. Dr. Brahima Kabo says a survey conducted jointly with the U.S. Centers for Disease Control found that 70% of infections did not come from either the country's Ebola holding centers or treatment facilities. He was reacting to the death over the weekend of yet another doctor, Sierra Leone's 10th. Dr. Aya Solomon Konoyima died on Saturday. Dr. Kabo tells me that Dr. Konoyima was the third Sierra Leone doctor to die from Ebola since last Friday.
We lost Dr. Konoyima, who was admitted with Dr. Songubiwa almost about 2 weeks ago at the Hastings Hospital. Dr. Songubiwa tested negative. He was discharged. And just on Monday or Tuesday, I think the father of Dr. Konoyima, we were told, had a stroke. He died, and somebody gave him the information, and since then he was down. He was no longer very active until we lost him yesterday.
We hear, Dr. Brightman, that Dr. Konoyima is the third in 48 hours that you have lost.
Yes, we have Dr. Tom Rogers and Dr. Kuruma, who were buried yesterday, and also Dr. Konoyima. But it's also interesting to note that a survey was conducted together with CDC, and it came out very clear that more than 70% of our infection did not come from either our holding or treatment facilities. So it is actually very difficult for us to actually fully understand where the doctors are getting this infection.
Some people say that Ebola is called the caretaker's disease. Is it true that they could be getting it from the patients that they are treating?
Most definitely. Because at the end of the day, if you follow the trend of the disease, the most affected persons are the healthcare workers and the caregivers of those who are taking care of patients infected with the virus. And most of the people who actually come to our facilities will not be able to tell you whether they are directly linked with any Ebola patient. They will not tell you the full story. Despite the fact that we have also encouraged medical personnel to always use their protective equipment whenever they are examining patients. So I'm sure they may have had this infection from either examining a patient or treating a patient.
The latest report by the World Health Organization says that at least 80 to 100 new cases of Ebola in Sierra Leone. What is happening? Is this disease coming back to your country?
Yeah, well, for November, I have to be honest, November, we had the highest number of cases since we had the outbreak in May. But for the past 3 days, we have been having encouraging figures. Although we will not be able to say, yes, we are out of the woods yet, but for the past 3 days, the figures are far lower than we saw in the month of November 2014.
Does your country need additional assistance?
Well, of course, we continue to receive the assistance. For example, 2 days ago, we received 100 medical practitioners from Nigeria under the justice of the African Union. And we also have about 27 ECOWAS health professionals that actually came to the country. We have the Cubans, we have the Chinese. Of course, we do require more assistance, but notwithstanding that, even if we have this assistance, if we do not adequately protect ourselves, then we'll continue to actually get the infection.
Dr. Brightman Kabo is Sierra Leone's chief medical officer. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown.
The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, has launched an anti-malaria campaign in Sierra Leone. The agency says reducing malaria cases will also help the fight against Ebola. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
This is the peak of the malaria season, and many people are expected to fall ill and die from the disease. The campaign aims to reach around 2.4 million people with anti-malarial drugs. The UN Children's Fund reports more than 9,300 trained community health workers will go door to door in areas of Sierra Leone where the risk of Ebola is highest. UNICEF Crisis Communications Chief Sarah Crow says the health workers will distribute anti-malarial drugs to everyone 6 months and older.
The point of this is really to reduce, obviously, malaria, but also to ease the strain on the health services of people who are coming in with symptoms of malaria, because, as you know, malaria mimics a lot of the early symptoms of Ebola. So by giving out these drugs, it really aims to as well expose the real Ebola cases.
Malaria symptoms of fever, headache, and aching joints are similar to Ebola in its early stages. The disease is often misdiagnosed. This causes confusion among patients and healthcare workers, and people with malaria often are referred to Ebola treatment units. UNICEF says malaria tablets being distributed will reduce the number of people exhibiting a high fever. This, it says, will result in fewer patients having to be screened for Ebola and put into isolation units. It also will reduce the risk of malaria patients contracting Ebola. Crow tells VOA a community-based approach is the best way of combating these dual diseases.
I think key to the approach is really that we know we can't treat our way out of Ebola. So the community approach, by building up the response at community level through community care centers, is really critical.
The UNICEF-supported anti-malarial campaign will go on for several weeks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
There is growing rejection in Liberia of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf's Executive Order No. 65, which prohibits all concerted mass movements of people on the streets of the capital, Monrovia, during the special senatorial election, which is supposed to be held next Tuesday if the Supreme Court lifts its current stay order. The president said Executive Order No. 65 is intended to strengthen government's efforts to contain the spread of the Ebola and protect the security of the state. Robert Sirleaf, the president's own son, who is an independent candidate in the Montserrado County senatorial race, says he will file a lawsuit today, Monday, against the government because he says Executive Order No. 65 discriminates against Montserrado County citizens.
I think one of the things you have to point out about the order that really speaks to the people of Monrovia. And that's why we found it discriminatory against the people of Monrovia when it didn't effectively speak to everybody in all the other counties. Basically, it should be a level playing field. If one party had a right, no timing to have their supporters go out, everybody should be put against the same playing field. So we think the timing is off. You have one party that has done it. And everybody deserves the same right. I mean, it's changing the rules of the games in the middle of the game.
You are saying you plan to file a legal action?
That is our plan next week. We just think it's discriminatory, and we really want the court to settle what we feel is a big injustice against the people of Monrovia. And that's the court system. Our approach is going to be strictly to the courts. We're not going to do anything outside of the decision of the courts or the direction of the courts that they're going to tell us to do, and we're going to respect that decision.
You said next week, and when do you hope to go in? Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday? When do you hope to file?
Yeah, we would expect to go in on Monday.
How do you feel going against, particularly taking legal action against a decision made by the government headed by your mother?
I don't think it plays into it at all, James. I mean, you know, we're an independent candidate. We're an independent movement. This is really on the behalf of the people of Monrovia. That was the statement, and we stand by that. It's not about Robert Sirleaf and Ellen. It's against an order that we feel we need to represent the people of Monrovia.
Mr. Sirleaf, as you know, there's legal action with the Supreme Court. Some people have challenged the constitutionality of this election itself. And so the court has put a stay. I read a comment by one of your opponents who said you violated that stay.
I think that their redress is to the NEC and their redress is to the courts. If they feel we've done it, we don't feel we've done anything to violate. We respect all the laws of the Republic. We definitely respect all the laws that are passed on by the Supreme Court. Everybody has a legal way of redressing things that they feel they're doing wrong, including ourselves. So we're no different. We're in the same position as everybody is.
Robert Sirleaf is the son of President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf and an independent candidate in the Mosorado County senatorial race. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. 14 members of the House of Representatives from Mosorado County have also criticized Executive Order No. 65, saying it signals the return to the days of military rule in Liberia. Also, the Alternative National Congress ANC party says Executive Order 65 is unconstitutional. Wilfred Passaway, chairman of the ANC USA branch, says President Sirleaf has taken powers that she can only exercise when given to her by the legislature in an emergency situation.
I think what the president is asking for, to effectively immediately ban mass movement of people gathering, these are very clearly prescribed for or allowed for and protected within the Constitution. And so any attempt to deny citizens those rights, the very Constitution laid out the method, the manner in which that could be done. That has to be done on an emergency order, emergency power. So to exercise emergency power, the president must secure the approval of the legislature. I mean, I think it's as simple as that. That's how we see it. I mean, we don't think there's any other interpretation that can satisfy the executive order.
So what does your group want? Would you like for the president to rescind the order?
Oh, we do. I mean, we're very clear about that in our statement. We don't agree with the president's executive order. We will pursue the legal means to challenge it. I mean, that's the best way to do it. Now, some people argue, well, why go to the court? The court might not side with you. Unfortunately, that's the best way to resolve the matter. It's very easy to attempt to go on the street and make a large gathering, challenging, go rowdy, and destroy properties and lives. At the end of the day, it doesn't move us in the direction we as a country need to move.
Wilfred Passaway is chairman of the Alternative National Congress ANC Party, USA branch. He was speaking with me from Washington. You're listening to Daybreak Africa, and I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 and a half minutes past the hour. Employees of the Malawi Anti-Corruption Bureau say they will go on strike beginning today, Monday, if the government does not increase their salaries by about 70%. This comes as President Peter Mutharika and his vice president were given an 80% raise, although the two said over the weekend that they will not take the increase until the economic situation in Malawi improves. Finance Minister Goodall Gondwe says Anti-Corruption Bureau employees are the highest paid, and to grant their request would defeat the government's civil service salary harmonization program. But Rene Kemetemba, deputy director of the Malawi Anti-Corruption Bureau, says the employees' request for higher pay is based on the terms of their employment contract.
If you look at their contracts, the terms and conditions of employment for their contracts, they clearly say that a raise or an increase in the salaries of civil servants will also result in an increase in the salaries of the Anti-Corruption Bureau officers. And there is also an article in their terms and conditions of service which clearly states that the increment which the members of the Bureau will get will be above that of the civil servants. So the notice that I've seen that has been addressed to the Principal Secretary or the Minister of Labour, and it says by the 8th of December, not hear from government, they'll go on strike.
The finance minister, Goodall Gondwe, has been quoted as saying that to implement your request will be contrary to the purpose of harmonization of salaries in the civil service.
I would not want to comment much on what the Minister of Finance said, but what I said earlier on was just to tell you the content of the notice that I've seen. Their basis is their contracts. To them, it's contractual. Those are the terms and conditions of their contracts. Obviously, if you hear what government is saying, it makes sense. I think as a country, we're going through some turbulent financial times. On the other hand, here you have officers of the Bureau trying to enforce their contractual rights. We are hopeful that government will find a way of engaging officers of the Bureau to resolve this standoff. It's not doing anybody any good. I think they admit losers are Malawians.
Why don't the employees go to court? It's better to go to court than to go on strike, whereby you might disrupt the responsibilities of the Anti-Corruption Bureau.
Again, I also refer to the notice that I've seen. It clearly states that their option was to go to court. But because the courts are almost dysfunctional, their option was to go on strike after 8 days. You might be aware that the judiciary in Malawi is on strike, so the courts are not functioning.
As you know, in Malawi, there's this cash gate scandal and the fight against corruption. What does that do to the fight against corruption?
Obviously, it will have an impact, especially with respect to investigations. But like I said earlier on, I'll repeat what I said, to officers of the Bureau, they're trying to enforce their contractual rights because they have referred to the terms and conditions that are available in their contracts. I am told every year when there is a raise in government salaries, they also get a raise. That's exactly what they're trying to get from government.
Renick Matemba is Deputy Director of the Malawi Anti-Corruption Bureau. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. The United States is awarding $15,000 grant to 5 U.S. universities that are partnering with Ethiopian schools on research and development projects. The initiative by the State Department and the Department of Education is designed to strengthen the skills of faculty and administrators in both countries. One grant will be used to train Ethiopian women on how to grow crops as part of an effort to address food insecurity. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins has the story.
Through classroom instruction and work on demonstration farms, the University of Maryland will provide training on how to grow food throughout the year with a goal of improving food security. University Technical Advisor Becky Ramsing says they hope to help women in Ethiopia who may have had limited access to training opportunities.
If you give the woman the resources, those resources will directly go to the family. And when women are given added income or able to raise more food, that directly relates to the children and the education and the nutrition of the child.
She says the goal is to train staff members at Deborah Bahan University who will then teach women in useful techniques such as growing food in small spaces.
Some of these women don't have access to land. How can we do container gardening, vertical gardening, livestock like small poultry?
Sige Mariam Bashe is a program facilitator and dean at Deborah Bahan. She says an overall goal is empowerment.
Empowering women is empowering the whole population or empowering the society.
Deborah Bahan facilitator Hailu Tarifa says only men are traditionally taught farming in some parts of the country.
There is cultural differences. In Ethiopia, all the regions do not have the same culture. There are regions that women are not allowed to go for agricultural practices.
Sige Mariam Bashe hopes the women who are trained will in turn assist other women.
I hope in the near future, women in the project become the community educator.
The other U.S. university grant recipients are Brown, Bowling Green State, Ball State, and the University of North Texas Libraries. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, the State Department.
In the United States, protests escalated over grand jury decisions declining to charge white police officers in the deaths of black males in New York and Missouri. VOA's Michael Bowman reports the demonstrations, the most widespread and persistent pertaining to race and justice seen in the country in decades, are forcing officials to respond and putting law enforcement under a powerful microscope.
Protests turned violent in Berkeley, California, where rocks and bricks were thrown and windows smashed. Police responded with tear gas as unrest continued for hours. More peaceful but no less fervent demonstrations continued in New York, Washington, Chicago, and other major cities.
We bluntly have to talk about the historic racial dynamics that underlie this.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio.
We have to have an honest conversation in this country about a history of racism. We have to have an honest conversation about the problem that has caused parents to feel their children may be in danger in their dynamics with police, when in fact police are there to protect them. We have to transcend that.
Can't breathe, don't shoot. Can't breathe, don't shoot.
The mayor says the city's police force, one of America's biggest, will be retrained to improve its dealings with minority communities and, it is hoped, avoid deadly confrontations like the one between officers and unarmed illegal cigarette vendor Eric Garner, who died earlier this year after being wrestled to the ground and forcibly restrained. De Blasio has spoken publicly of difficult conversations with his biracial son, telling him to be extra cautious if approached by police.
Don't move suddenly, don't reach for your cell phone, because we knew, sadly, there was a greater chance it might be misinterpreted if it was a young man of color.
Those comments have drawn the ire of police representatives who accuse the mayor of scapegoating rather than defending those who risk their lives to ensure public safety. New York Police Union Chief Patrick Lynch.
You cannot resist arrest, because resisting arrest leads to confrontation. Confrontation leads to tragedy.
Grand jury decisions declining criminal prosecution of police officers have grabbed the world's attention in recent weeks, but have been the norm for decades, according to criminal law professor James Jacobs.
Police officers have a certain, presumption of legitimacy in the community. It's recognized that they have a very hard job to do.
Last week, President Barack Obama said public confidence in U.S. law enforcement must be restored, along with faith that laws will be applied equally to all Americans. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
Time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with basketball. In a thrilling All-Angolan showdown, defending champions Interclub pipped Primeiro de Agosto 75-74 at the Africa Women's Club Basketball Championship final in Sfax, Tunisia on Sunday. Earlier on, Tunisia's CS Sfaxien beat Nigeria's First Bank 75-61 in the bronze medal playoff. Nigeria's Dolphins edged the Republic of Congo's INSS 76-67 in the fifth place playoff, while Tunisia's CS Police Orientation dismissed Kenya Port Authority 74-56 to place seventh. Turning to athletics, Kenya's former world marathon record holder Patrick Makau clocked 2 hours 8 minutes and 22 seconds to win the Fukuoka Marathon in convincing style in Japan on Sunday. Ethiopian Raji Asefa was runner-up ahead of Mongolia's Ser Od Bat Ochir. In rugby news, South Africa beat Australia 33-7 to win the second leg of the IRB Sevens rugby tournament in Dubai, United Arab Emirates on Saturday, while Canada beat Kenya 19-12 in the finals of the Shield category. South Africa now lies second in the series standings with 37 points, while Kenya is 14th with 4 points. Turning to football, a late goal by Emad Moteb handed Egypt's El Ahly a 1-0 triumph over Ivory Coast's Sewe Sport in the return leg of the Orange Africa Confederations Cup finals in Cairo, Egypt on Saturday. Although tied 2-2 on aggregate, El Ahly win the Confederations Cup on the away goal rule, having lost 2-1 in the opening round in Abidjan last week. This is El Ahly's 19th African club title and their first ever Africa Confederations Cup trophy. In Canada, African champions Nigeria Super Falcons face Sweden in Winnipeg on the 8th of June at the start of their campaign at the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup. They will also face Australia and the United States of America in their group preliminaries. According to the draws conducted in Ottawa on Saturday, tournament debutants Cameroon face fellow debutants Ecuador on the 8th of June in Vancouver before going on to challenge another debutant Switzerland and world champions Japan, while Ivory Coast get their baptism of fire on the world stage when they face Germany on the 7th of June in Ottawa. They will also play Norway and fellow tournament debutants Thailand in the other group matches. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
And thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, December 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that you will have a very productive week.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.